We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Baseball is back, and so is MLB.tv. Watch every out-of-market, regular season game on your favorite streaming devices. Anywhere, anytime, all season long. Follow the action live or on demand. Track four games at once with multi-view mode and catch up with in-game highlights. Plus, original programs, minor league broadcasts, and local pre- and post-game shows. Go to MLB.tv to start your free trial today. Blackout and other restrictions apply. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. Thanks a lot for joining us for today's podcast titled Coronavirus Facts Only. Every day around this time, I'm talking with Dr. Fred Buchholz. Dr. Buchholz is a SLU care general internist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital about coronavirus and COVID-19. What do we need to know? How do we keep ourselves safe? And what lies ahead in the uncertain future? Dr. Buchholz, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Always happy to.
So we had a weekend of more press briefings from the White House. One of the big things that came up was the talk from the president about hydroxychloroquine as a possible treatment for coronavirus. What's your take on hydroxychloroquine?
Well, hydroxychloroquine is like one of those things that shows some promise, and some small work has been done. Granted, most of it is really, when I say it's bad science, it's being kind to it. I mean, it's stuff that in normal times would never even see the light of day, because it's just the way they've done the work is just, frankly, a pile of garbage. But because we're in a crisis and we're looking for anything, we are paying a little bit more attention to it and trying to be a little bit more open-minded to it. There is a potential as an effect. I don't think it's a life-saving cure that if everybody takes it, or if we give it to seriously ill patients, that it's going to save everybody. I highly doubt that. We are using it. We have protocols in our own institution. A lot of places are doing this where they're going to give it along with an antibiotic called azithromycin, the patients that are pretty severely ill, not because we know this works, but recognizing that we're trying to kind of, for patients that are kind of dying and we don't have much to really provide, this is kind of just kind of throwing the kitchen sink at them and just seeing if it works. But I think there's other things out there that have a lot more promise. Remdesivir, which is, where my own institution is kind of leading a trial on, certainly has a little bit more, it makes more biologic sense in terms of treatment. But I think the emphasis right now should be less on, treating the people that are very sick that already have it, although that's a huge emphasis. I mean, I don't want to say that's not important. But really the main job and the task at a policy level, at the state, local, and federal levels, really should be about reducing spread. That's what's going to save our lives. That's going to have the maximum impact, and that's things we know work. Making sure we have equipment, making sure that people stay separated, making sure that we can test when we have any suspicion of this, and that test is readily available so we can use it and deploy it and figure things out. Right now, we're still limited in all those things, and that's the biggest problem, and that's what I wish our leaders would focus on, frankly. The last thing about, using or touting this hydroxychloroquine in the setting where we're not sure if it works or not is that we have patients, and a huge number of patients in the United States, that need this drug, and it's potentially life-saving to them for the treatment of their autoimmune disease. And so as we kind of tout this as a kind of a solution without a real solution, the supplies of that drug really kind of dwindle, and the patients that really need it are not going to get it. And that's, again, from these, it's a consequence of saying this type of stuff that's not factually based. It creates real changes in supply and demand that have massive catastrophic consequences. It's worrisome. It's just an unforced error in my mind of worrying about the wrong stuff and then causing more problems for the population of the United States.
Tell us some more about the Z-Pak or azithromycin that's being used in combination with hydroxychloroquine.
Yeah, and that's, again, same thing is, you know, azithromycin has been used. It is an antibiotic, but it's been used in a lot of different situations as what we call an anti-inflammatory drug. So there's some, you know, there's some evidence that, you know, people with certain conditions, it has a little bit of benefit. Again, it's not one of these things that I'm kind of hoping to be kind of a life-saving issue or a game changer in terms of the treatment of these patients. Again, in desperation, we're giving it to people. There's certainly a risk and a reasonably high concern that if we give hydroxychloroquine and azithromycin to patients that are already quite sick, it can cause cardiac, the word we use is arrhythmias, but it's basically the electrical conduction of the heart gets into disarray and can cause cardiac arrest. And so, you know, this is why we do good science, because we have a treatment that seems like it works. But you have to treat patients with it and then treat people with a placebo and do the right science to see if it causes more harm than benefit or causes more benefit than harm. You know, as I said before, you know, if I put coronavirus in a test tube and add bleach to it, bleach will kill virus. It's a very good virus killer. The problem is that I can't give you bleach. You know, I can't make you swallow it or give it to you IV. It will kill you faster than the virus will. So that's the issue. We've got to find what that relative benefit and risk is and decide if this saves lives or harms lives or does nothing. And we don't know that answer. And I get that we're in a pandemic and we want to desperately help people, but we've got to also realize we may be inadvertently killing people too, which is, you know, against our first principle, the first do no harm.
We're talking with Dr. Fred Buchholz. Dr. Buchholz is a slew care general internist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Dr. Buchholz, we've had a weekend now of universal mask or face coverings nationally. What's your thoughts or advice so far?
Well, you know, again, I think that it combined with a strategy of social distancing and, you know, high quality, frequent hand washing, face masks are basically another piece in that puzzle. You know, as I've mentioned before, they're probably particularly if you're using a cloth face mask, the benefit really is in preventing you from spreading potentially the virus and you being protected from it. But, you know, what I worry and certainly hope is not the case is that people wearing face masks have a false sense of security, which they should not have. In other words, you know, if you're wearing a face mask and you're not adhering to social distancing practices, that's probably causing more harm than good. And so, you know, I think as part of this kind of multi-pronged strategy of keeping everybody away, you know, at least for a while longer. I mean, we're 2 weeks into this now. I think now the next week to 10 days is really going to show, particularly in the region, what this does or if this has an effect. But, you know, I don't want to give people the false sense of security that this is going to protect them. It's not. It's just a component of a strategy that might be effective.
And your strong suggestion, again, Dr. Buchholz, is to leave the higher-level surgical mask and N95 mask for the healthcare workers and those who are really sick.
Yeah, no, that's really where the effect is there. And again, I think experience out of Wuhan and certainly just kind of anecdotally what I've seen is that, you know, I think the biggest concern we have in healthcare is the inadvertent spread. And again, not from people being malicious about the equipment or being cavalier about protection. It's just more the, you know, I've already heard cases and stories and have been dealing with situations where patients come in. We don't know their status, but they don't have the classic fever, myalgias, and respiratory symptoms, but they're in the hospital for another reason. And they end up being positive. And it's just kind of out of a guess. And we actually have to push to get the testing because it doesn't make much sense. And we have a limitation in the amount of tests we have. You know, we're trying to use this intelligently and boom, they're positive. And then you go back and that person say was, you know, at a clinic or at another healthcare facility and how many people are inadvertently exposed and then now how many of them are now spreading it and they feel completely fine. That's a huge, huge issue. And the only way to really deal with that is good testing and good personal protective equipment that's consistently on. And we can't do that because we have such a shortage right now. We're trying to ration and reuse. And I just can't tell you the level of desperation. Look in New York, these groups making, you know, gallons out of trash bags. I mean, come on. I mean, what are we? you know, the fact that we can't get those people supplies that they need is a national failure. It's just embarrassing and frustrating when you're on the lines dealing with this, for sure.
You talk a lot about ramping up the testing. What does that mean?
I mean, it's just basically having availability to do tests. So there's two limitations that, again, I'm going from my own experience. I can't speak nationally, but just the two limitations we have right now is, one, having the equipment to get the test. That's that nasal swab, which is basically a Q-tip, a long Q-tip. We stick in your nose to the back of your throat to get a sample to test. And then having the kit to test this. The actual concept of the test is pretty simple. It's easy to do. We do it all the time for lots of different things, but just having the equipment and the material to do that has been a limitation. And again, everybody's trying to order this. Everybody wants to get this. So it's kind of a free-for-all of who gets a test and who doesn't. But a lot of my colleagues and myself, and again, I'm not touting anybody's official policy. This is really, frankly, my own opinion is, you know, if somebody comes to our emergency room, either they're coming in for like a cut on their head that needs some stitches, I think we should test them. You know, let's get established what we know, what they have or don't have it, and then kind of siphon them off to one area of the hospital versus another to prevent cross-contamination. And we can't do that very well. And then the only way to deal with that appropriately is to use a bunch of our personal protective equipment, assuming everybody may have this. But if you have universal testing or you can test as much as you want, you at least can get a better idea of who does and who doesn't have the disease and appropriately separate people and prevent the people that are infected from getting others infected. And that's, to us, the biggest struggle. And we're trying. My goodness, the whole region is trying. Our colleagues at Barnes and at Mercy and St. Luke's Systems trying to work together. It's really been great from a community standpoint, but you know, we just need a better distribution system at a level above us. And frankly, above the states, because Missouri is competing with Illinois and with Kansas and with New York and California, et cetera, et cetera. It's crazy.
We're talking with Dr. Fred Buchholz. Dr. Buchholz is a slough care general internist at SSML St. Louis University Hospital. Let's talk a little bit about that regional cooperation that's going on, Dr. Buchholz. We've got the new St. Louis Metropolitan Pandemic Task Force now meeting, led by Dr. Alexander Garza. Dr. Garza is the chief medical officer for SSML St. Louis. He was also the chief medical officer for Homeland Security. What are you hearing from this group?
Yeah, so it seems relatively new, and I think it's kind of more of a organizational deployment of things that are already happening. I mean, again, we were working, and again, this is a bit above my pay grade, but we were working pretty well with our colleagues of trying to think through policy, think through steps, think through how to help each other with equipment and use that appropriately. And I think just organizing this a bit more of an umbrella leadership that's a little bit more organized and frankly, you know, hopefully has some community input, I think will be really important. And I've met and worked with him on a couple of occasions. And again, it's a man that knows what he's doing. And he's been, you know, from the onset, you know, gosh, I'd say 6 to 8 weeks ago, planning and preparing us for this. And so, you know, I've got to give him credit for recognizing the threat early and trying to deal with it, at least within our own system, as best as possible. I'm glad they're doing this. And again, I'm really pleased that the region is working together rather than working kind of in islands. I think that's a positive thing from this. I'm quite happy about.
Over the weekend, I believe Dr. Garza said that if things stay the way they are and people continue social distancing, we should be okay hospitalization space-wise. But if they don't, if they get lax in some of these precautions, then things are going to be really bad.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, we're now 2 weeks into, you know, the county and city having a shelter-in-place order. I think the data and the events of this week, or really the next 10 days, I'd say, would be, I think, really dictate how the region goes. You know, do we continue to double in the number of patients we have every couple of days, or does that get spread out more and more? And I track the data every day, and you know, the numbers are starting to look okay from that standpoint, but the problem is we don't really know because we still have limited testing. So it's hard to really feel totally reassured by this. But, you know, I think the number of hospitalizations and the patients we care for in our region is going to be the biggest driver. You know, will we get this huge spike like we saw in New York City, or will it be kind of a more even kind of spread of patients that we see throughout the next month or two, or maybe even longer? I think the next 2 weeks will really tell us that. So I'm really curious to see the effects of the shelter-in-place order.
When is the peak expected in this area?
So I've been told April 15th. And again, I'm not sure I would consider that a moving target. You know, as I mentioned many times before, I think we were fairly early in instituting the shelter in place. And I think that might, you know, despite the, you know, I get for businesses and many people not working right now that the impact of that is magnificent. But in terms of lives saved, I think it's going to have an impact. So I think that 15 seems like a reasonable number. That's all the people that may have been carrying this for some time as they kind of manifest and may have gotten others sick. But, you know, again, as we know with this, things keep on changing. You know, we think we know something and then 5 days later that's completely changed or we learned something new. So, you know, we make a guess knowing that guess is has a decent chance of being wrong. And I think all of us are getting used to that.
We're talking with Dr. Fred Buchholz. Dr. Buchholz is a SLU care general internist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. I've got some more listener questions for you, Dr. Buchholz. This listener wants to know, is there any risk of the virus going through her apartment's HVAC system?
You know, that's a question that's been floated quite a bit, and I think there's a concern. If I recall correctly, back when the Japanese, that cruise ship went to Japan and seemed to spread fairly quickly through there, even though people were isolated. I think we feel pretty confident that, you know, that 6-foot kind of radius of our zone of where the particulates really spread is I think, kind of become a consistent fact. You know, I think a lot of variables have to be at play for it to be aerosolized enough and then spread through an HVAC system. So one in the apartment complex, it would have to be a shared HVAC system, which isn't in all places. And then two would be, you know, you'd have to have like a critical concentration of particulates getting into the system. So it's not only have to like sneeze multiple times into the vent or something, and then the flow would have to be such that it gets there. So I don't want to say it's impossible. I think it's highly unlikely. And, you know, I guess in New York, which is probably the biggest risk area. And again, going back to Wuhan as well, where, you know, very densely populated city where a lot of people live in apartments. You know, once they did the shelter in place, it didn't seem to spread that consistently. So I think it's less of a threat, frankly.
Another listener wants to know, is takeout food safe?
That's a good question. My wife and I have been arguing about that for the last couple of days. It's hard to know. You know, I think anywhere where you can't really trace the domain of where your food's been and who's been touching and who's been practicing good, safe hygienic practices is a question. You know, same thing like with produce at the store. I mean, how many people have, you know, handled that tomato that you're looking at and handling right now? It's hard to know. I would say generally cooked hot food is going to kill most pathogens and is probably safe. And again, same thing with vegetables. You know, if you wash it thoroughly, you've probably done as much to get rid of things as you need to. So, you know, I don't know. We certainly are doing a lot of our own preparation of food, but I think it's probably okay. It's hard to really know. And again, all you need is that one person. I guess there's a restaurant out in West County that a number of people were infected. So it just takes that one person to kind of spread this. So I'm not going to recommend it. I think it's an unknown. I'll say it that way.
Dr. Buchholz, I have another listener that wants to know, what is an oxygen sensor? Should we have one? What does it do?
Yeah, so an oxygen sensor, the ones you can buy commercially, is just it's a little device, typically it goes on your finger, and it uses basically an infrared or a laser to kind of make an estimate of the concentration of oxygen in your blood or the percentage of oxygen in your blood. What that means is basically the whole body system, our blood is designed to go to the lungs, get oxygen that we breathe in and distribute to our body. We need oxygen to conduct our metabolism or just basically to make, you know, our cells do the work that they need to do. And so generally the concentration of oxygen or the percentage is, you know, 95 to 100%. That's what these detectors measure. And again, it's a bit of a misnomer, but for our purposes, it's there. So the lower that number is somewhat typically correlated with shortness of breath. And, you know, when we see patients in the hospital, if they have problems with oxygenation, you know, that certainly is cause for us to kind of figure out what's going on and deal with that. they're not perfect. There's a lot of things that can make them read low, and you know, there's, it's kind of this, you have to make sure your nails are clean. You don't have nail polish on them, that type of thing. But it's decent. For people that have chronic respiratory issues, we use them to kind of monitor and see where they are. If you're used to using it, then we can kind of use it to gauge how you do it. So if you're not doing well and that oxygen level is low, we may want to come to the hospital. I think buying it for COVID, I think, is a bit of overkill. I think really what we care about, you know, if you're infected with COVID and it's severe, you're going to feel pretty bad. And if you're having respiratory symptoms or it's affecting your lungs, which is where we get very concerned, you're going to feel symptomatically short of breath. And so that's, to me, the symptom I would really pay attention to. If you're having a hard time breathing, or if you walk up a flight of stairs and normally can do without thinking about it, and you're really struggling, you know, those are things that say, well, maybe I need to get evaluated. And that's what I pay more attention to than the oxygenation itself. Again, I've seen lots of patients that you look at them and they're laboring and they're really having a hard time breathing and you're worried. And someone will do the oxygen meter and it'll say 100%. And you're just like, I don't care. This is not a good thing. And, you know, that's again, what separates, you know, the adults from the children in our world. But, you know, I've seen plenty of patients where they have the normal vital signs, so to speak, but they look terrible. And sure enough, that judgment plays out very often of that they're getting sick fast. And, you know, so I wouldn't rely on that number. I would rely on how you're feeling is the biggest driver of what you should do.
Dr. Buckle, thanks a lot for your time. Really do appreciate it. Talk to you again tomorrow.
All right. It's been great, Fred. Thank you.
Dr. Fred Buchholz is a SLU care general internist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. This is KMOX health editor Fred Bottomer. Thanks so much for joining us for today's podcast, Coronavirus Facts Only. Talk to you again tomorrow.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.